Today is November 22nd, Tuesday morning at Kiva. We're learning Parshat HaShavua, and this week's Parsha is Parshat Toldot. Parshat Toldot. Now, in Parshat Toldot, the overall theme are the two sons of Isaac and Rebekah, who are Esav and Yaakov and Jacob, and their relationship, and ultimately the theft of the blessing of one from the other. And we'll look inside, we'll read the story. We're going to read the story, but not only for the story's sake. What we really want to do is read the story in order to come to a very serious moral dilemma that runs as a common thread throughout the whole story. And that dilemma is, do the ends ever justify the means? Can thievery and deception be justified under any circumstances? So that's the question we are hoping to get to. Now, before we read the story, again, we're reading the story shortly. We're not going to focus on the details of the story, but rather get to the moral issue behind it. There are two matters that have to be put on the table before we read. And these are assumptions that the story seems to make. It doesn't matter if, as 21st century human beings, we accept the assumptions in our lives or not, but there's certainly assumptions within the story, assumptions that the characters make. The first assumption is that words spoken as a blessing are meaningful. They are crucial, they're critical, they have effect on reality in some sense. The question of who gets the blessing that God gave to Abraham, and Abraham gave to Yitzhak, and Yitzhak is about to pass on to his children, the question of who does he concretely bless when he says those words, when Isaac says those words, which son does he bless? The story seems to assume that that is a crucial question. That's number one. Number two is that in this story, the parents, Isaac and Rebekah, and the children, Esav and Jacob, are functioning and see themselves not only as individuals, but they have a sense of destiny. The question, who gets the blessing, is crucial, not only for them as individuals, but it's crucial for the future of what's going to become the Jewish people. Like, it's not just a matter of me, say, as an individual, am I going to get the greater part of inheritance from my family, from my father, from my mother, or is my brother going to get it? But it's rather a matter of the relationships, let's say, between Roosevelt and Churchill. The countries, the fate of the world is hanging upon it. Jacob knows, and Isaac knows, Rebecca knows, that this blessing is a blessing to lead a nation, that all the other nations of the world will be blessed through that nation. Who is fitting for that? Who gets the blessing? Who's going to take upon himself this humongous responsibility? So those are the two points. That it's a big issue, that the future of the world in a certain sense is hanging upon it. I'm exaggerating a little bit. And secondly, that really whoever gets the blessing in a physical, concrete sense, whose head is under the fingers of Isaac when he says the words, in some sense that's tremendously important. So now let's read
and the story. Blessings are irreversible.
Apparently.
Well, apparently. If they're powerful, then they're powerful. They speak. Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'll just add that I don't know for certain that the narrator believes that who gets the blessing is crucial, but the characters believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm, that's
right?
Interesting.
Right? The fact that the characters believe it doesn't mean that God believes it, but that's the way the story plays itself out, that they believe it. That we have to just
They're
accept
like
as a fact.
Little mice running around trying to...
Yeah. I've always wondered, why couldn't he just have said, you know what, Jacob tricked me, Esau, you're the man, all the blessings are yours.
Yes. Right.
Jacob gets nothing.
We're not going to go into all the details of the relationship between the characters. That I think we did last year, if not the year before. This time we're going to focus on the moral issues behind the matter. So we're moving to Genesis chapter 25, as the sheets say. Genesis chapter 25, Bereishit 25:21. Oops. And this gives us the background to the story, 25:21 at the end of the verse. The end of the verse. His wife, Rebekah, conceived. That's the wife of Isaac. 25:21. If anyone wants to say the page, or I guess you all have different editions.
Yes, it's hard to say the page, but the page means nothing.
His wife, Rebekah, conceived in verse 22, but the children struggled in her womb. In other words, she has twins. And she said, if so, why do I exist? She went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord answered her. And that's going to be important. This prophecy is vouchsafed to her, and we don't know if she told anyone. We don't know if she told her husband, even. Two nations are in your womb. Two separate peoples shall issue from your body. One people shall be mightier than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So she knows, even before the boys are born, that Yaakov, who's younger by a few seconds, he is meant to be the leader and to lead his older brother Esav. When her time came to give birth, there were twins in her womb. The first one emerged red like a hairy mantle all over, so they named him Esav. When his brother emerged holding onto the heel of Esav, so they named him Yaakov, which means the healer, the taker hold of the heel. Isaac was 60 years old when they were born. So again, for the story, the commentators, we could spend a lot of time in it, we're not going to do that. I just want to point out what almost all the commentators assume, that a hairy, red-hairy young man, that's symbolic of something animalistic. Both the hair, beast-like. Later we'll see that Jacob has to cover himself with skins of an animal to be similar in feeling to his brother. And that the hair is red, which symbolizes violence or blood. That's meaningful.
What does it symbolize?
Blood, violence. In other words, that Esav is not to be the...
But the
leader,
holding onto
people.
The heel is also highly symbolic.
It certainly symbolizes what will happen
odd.
The rest of his life, right? Mm-hmm. He's trying to get ahead. I would think in the context it could be that symbolically he knows he's supposed to be before his brother, but he can't get there.
Yeah.
Right? When the boys grew up, Esav was a skillful hunter, a man of the outdoors, and that ties into his being hairy and red. He's a man who kills. He's a hunter. By the way, Avram and Yitzhak were not hunters. Right? There were shepherds, and Isaac was also a farmer, but this is the first in the family of the Jewish people who's a hunter.
He's like, so this echoes of Cain and
right.
Abel also, with the different professions and the different kinds
like
of skills.
In that yes, sense, but neither of the two were hunters. Right? One was a shepherd, one was a farmer. And then it says that Jacob was an Ishtam. A man, Tam, who stayed in camp. Now, different translations probably translate those words differently. I purposely didn't say what my translation says. Ish Tam, well, that word Tam, although in later Hebrew, means simple, like in the simple son, in the Haggadah Pesach, but in biblical Hebrew, it doesn't mean that. Biblical Hebrew, for example, the man Job is called Tam Yashar V'Yirei Elokim. He is tam and upright and a fear of God.
Isn't Noach?
Noach is tamim. It's tzaddik tamim. Which in context means he's perfectly righteous.
I thought tam meant depth.
Depth?
Depth. Like if someone has tam, they've got some depth.
Oh, that's spelled differently.
What?
That's
what does she mean?
Someone with...
some character to
character,
you.
Tam. Like food, that's
Tom.
Ta'am.
Yeah, right, so she's pronouncing it properly. Okay. Ta'am. There's an I in there.
Okay.
That's so funny. Ilana didn't understand you.
Yeah.
She only knows it with the proper pronunciation. Very good, very good. So Tom really means he was perfect, he was upright, and that again is a contrast. By the way, what does the article say?
He was a wholesome man.
Wholesome, okay. Any other translations?
Tam is, Shnei Kvasim Tmimim.
Right, perfect.
Yeah.
Completely whole.
And it only refers to your character and not to a physical quality?
As far as the sacrifices go, it refers to a physical quality.
Because Noah was supposed to be, according to the Midrash, born circumcised, right?
very good. In
what,
other words,
what?
The midrash that says he was born circumcised, if there is such a midrash, I don't remember very well. If there is, we'll
about
be posted
Noach?
On that aspect that says that he was Tom. Yeah.
About Noach?
Yeah.
He was Moshe, born circumcised. Yeah.
But let's, that's what I'm allowed to do, okay? Yeah. Let's go on.
They said that when the Mashiach.
We're going to go on now.
Everybody will be born circumcised.
And just look at verse 28 before we go on to another chapter. Isaac favored Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebecca favored Jacob. So ready, each parent, right? There's a little bit of attention here in the family. Good morning, Liz. So we're going to go on to chapter 26, verse 34. 26:34, just to see the bare bones framework of the story. And the sheet you save for Bob, you'll have to give to Liz. Okay, so it's 26:34. When Esav was 40 years old, he took to wife Yehudi, daughter of Be'eri the Hittite, and Bosmat, daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah. So these two women are Hittites, which means they're Canaanites. They're not from the family of Abraham and Yitzhak back in the old country from Mesopotamia, from Haran. And we always know that the patriarchs were supposed to take wives from the family and not to take Canaanite wives. Well, Esav, he broke the mold, and that's part of what we're talking about, that we already see on a number of levels, from a number of different indications, that he's not meant to be the continuer of the line of Abraham and Yitzhak. His marriages were a source of bitterness to Isaac and Rebekah. Let's go on.
But the name of this wife, one of the wives, is very strange. Yehudit. Yeah, which is a name which sounds Jewish.
Yeah, but not then. Didn't sound Jewish then. Right? So we're going on to chapter 27. We're going to read the story of the theft of the brachot as it plays itself out in chapter 27. When Isaac was old, and his eyes were too dim to see, he called his older son Esau and said to him, "My son." He answered, "Here I am." And he said, "I am old now, and I do not know how soon I may die. Take your gear, your quiver and bow, and go out into the open, hunt me some game. Then prepare a dish for me such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my innermost blessing before I die." Rebekah had been listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Isaac had gone out into the open to hunt game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game and prepare a dish for me to eat, that I may bless you with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. Go to the flock and fetch me two choice kids, and I will make of them a dish for your father such as he likes. Then take it to your father to eat, in order that he may bless you before he dies.' Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, 'But my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am smooth-skinned. If my father touches me, I shall appear to him as a trickster and bring upon myself a curse, not a blessing.' But his mother said to him, 'Your curse, my son, be upon me. Just do as I say and go fetch them for me.' He got them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared a dish such as his father liked. Rebekah then took the best clothes of her older son Esau, which were there in the house, and had her younger son put them on. And she covered his hands and the hairless part of his neck with the skins of the kids. Then she put in the hands of her son Jacob the dish and the bread that she had prepared. He went to his father and said, 'Father.' And he said, 'Yes, which of my sons are you?' Jacob said to his father, 'I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Pray, set up into my game, that you may give me your innermost blessing.'" And the story plays itself out, that indeed, Isaac gives the blessing to Jacob, apparently thinking that it's Esau. So Isaac was tricked. His son Jacob tricked him, deceived him. And not only that, but Jacob also stole. He stole the blessing from his son, his brother Esau. So, as I said, we're going to talk about the question, both in the story and in general, did Yaakov do the right thing? Let's say Yaakov and his mother, did they do the right thing? Do the ends justify the means?
And to even make it more extreme, when Rivka offers him that, he is not shunning from it
His only reservation is that his father will find out and he's in danger. Mm-hmm. He has not at all a moral dilemma about it.
Hmm. Could be that you're right. That
and you know, I always thought Isaac comes across as so, like, how can he not tell his son?
There's a hint that he does tell.
He was a willing dude.
Yeah. So you know what? Those are important questions that we discussed you last year, the year before, 2 years ago. Yeah. We can't do everything every year. Sorry about that. And let's realize the implications that this question has for so many areas of life. Just to give some of the examples that I put in the sheet, from a male perspective, every husband has a dilemma. What does he say to his wife when she says, "Do you like my new dress?"
Yes.
Or do I look fat?
No.
So that's a question again. Do the ends justify the means?
Sometimes.
Are you allowed to lie in order to preserve peace in the family? Or what about someone who's suffering not from a dangerous disease, but extremely painful disease? Are you allowed to lie to obtain the medicine that he or she needs to save them from their terrible suffering? Or steal? Or cheat in Medicaid, whatever it might be, or Medicare? I don't know the difference. I'm sorry about that. I'm not old enough yet.
Yes, can't we call it a constructive restatement of the facts as opposed to a lie?
Call it whatever you want, but it's forbidden in of itself, right? But is there anything that justifies it? Right? I put some other examples here. There's lying to save human life. There's the easiest example of self-defense. Right? If I kill someone who's about to kill me, well, I killed him. That's murder, isn't it?
No, that's homicide. There's a difference.
Okay, but I took a gun and I did an action that caused the person to be dead in a pool of blood.
Well,
it's a homicide. It's not a murder.
But the Nazis come knocking on the door and say, is there a Jew in your house?
Ah.
That's. Yeah.
There's a famous story of Immanuel Kant, mm-hmm. right? The great ethicist and philosopher of the 18th century, and I remember this from college, I can testify that it's 100% true, that he said that if you have hidden in your house fugitives who did not necessarily do anything wrong, but they're being pursued by someone who wants to kill them, and that person who's pursuing them knocks on the door, you open up, you see him standing there with a knife saying, "Where are the people I'm looking for? Are they here?" Kant said, "You can't lie." Can't lie.
Cannot lie.
Cannot lie.
Really?
Because lying is forbidden.
Why is it forbidden?
Not for now. Okay, not for now. We have to isolate the issue.
Okay, and also, you know, here in America, there were people who were doing the railroad for the slaves.
The Underground Railroad.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. It really is.
Question?
Although, I'm not sure there if it's the same thing.
It was against the law.
It's against the law, but it might have been a higher law that they were.
But they were still lying about it.
Right. Okay. They were still lying. You're right. They were still lying.
Yeah. Can I just make a murder is an unlawful killing. There are many killings, even in the Bible, that were ordered by God. If a killing is a righteous killing, it's not a murder.
Okay, but that's the question. That's the question.
Mm-hmm.
That's question. Yeah. Could there ever be such a thing? Let me just give you one more example.
There's an answer.
I think there's a certain and this comes up probably more often than we think. Let's take someone who is brought into the emergency room after a terrible car crash. And the doctors have him on the operating table, and he's clearly going to die in another 5 minutes. But he's not dead yet. If those organs are harvested, 5 human lives can be saved. Mm-hmm. Lungs, heart, right? Kidneys, liver. But if you wait 5 minutes till he dies, some of those organs might be lost. Do you kill this person and save 5 lives?
Absolutely not.
The question, right? You might say that the ends justify the means, to save 5 lives. So this stuff is really difficult.
I think it's just, you know, what are the ends and what are the means?
Now, of course, but I'm saying even if it's clear
that the ends are laudable, to save five lives. And all that you're doing is snuffing out our life, you're shortening a life for 5 minutes. In a kind of quantitative sense, it looks like a no-brainer. But that's the question. Do the ends justify the means?
You're taking all the life he has left.
Say it again, please.
Yeah.
You're taking all the life he has left.
Yeah, and the questions are so complicated. But let's just try and isolate it in theory. Now, we could take a in-principle stance. I'm not saying as Jews, but in general, an in-principle stance that the ends never justify the means. Because law is law, and right is right. You can't do wrong, period, no matter what you might accomplish. Because you have to look at the matter in and of itself.
It also connects with animal rights.
How so?
If we start with the end justifies the means, we are allowed to do all these experiments that are cruel on animals. We're allowed to kill animals in order to eat them.
Perhaps, right. So you could take a position that is a principled position that one is never allowed to do wrong because wrong is wrong and wrong taints. Wrong is absolutely wrong. You can't lie, you can't cheat, you can't steal, you can't deceive. And of course, you can't murder even to save your own life. You could take that position.
But doesn't it come down to the fact that if you make the decision, you're never going to lie, and then there may be occasions that come up that make you reconsider it? Or do you take the position that every time I decide whether I'm going to tell the truth or take the lie, do I make a decision then? So basically the issue is you don't lie, and then there may be highly unusual circumstances that cause you to reconsider it.
Okay, so that's saying that in principle it could be that the ends sometimes justify the means. Of course, not always. Obviously not always. It's going to be a difficult weighing. But what's clear is, if you take the position the ends never justify the means, then life is black and white. And there are clear rules. Whereas the minute you say, even once, the ends justify the means, you're liable to the slippery slope.
Exactly.
And you can certainly say the slippery slope is so slippery that it's not worth the good you might do in one or two or three cases because of the evil that will occur if you open up the door, the Pandora's box, because you never know where it will lead to.
I think that's how the Amish live, with a kind of black and white life.
And it makes some sense.
It makes some sense. You end up, until you have two conflicting rights, which is the issue, always save a life and always tell the truth. And then you end up with the conflicting things where you say that, hey, if I'm going to save that life, I need to lie. So you have two conflicting things, and that's when you have to make the decision.
When both consequences are evil, you choose the lesser of two evils. Because if by not acting, you sacrifice your life, but you know that morally you can save your life by taking another life, then you take the other life. I mean, it's an evil act, but it's the lesser of two evils.
Or you take the rote of what's called in Hebrew, shev al taseh, do nothing. In other words, it's perhaps better to do nothing, even if evil results, than to positively get up and do an evil act. Like just that example.
Sometimes doing nothing is more evil than...
Save a life, or... I don't care, but it's save a life or don't lie.
Look at Socrates.
If I don't lie, then someone might die, but I didn't do anything wrong.
Well, the Nazis come knocking on the door and they say, are you hiding a Jew? And you go,
Socrates?
No. That's worse. I mean,
okay. But there are those who might say that you should never positively get up and do a wrong act, no matter what the consequences.
Look at Socrates. He takes the poison and doesn't deny his word.
Yeah.
But the Tanakh seems to take the position that it is okay under certain circumstances.
Indeed, and we're getting there.
Right.
Okay, so Adam says, let's go on.
Move forward.
Okay, so we're going on now to show, this is C on my sheets, the aftermath of this lying and deception for the family, and later in D, the aftermath for Jacob himself. So we're looking at 27:32. Which says as follows, 27:32. After Father Isaac indeed blessed Jacob, thinking he was Esav, And then Esav comes into the room and says, "Here I am with the venison." His father Esav said to him, "Who are you?" This is to Esav. And he said, "I'm your son Esav, your firstborn." Isaac was seized with very violent trembling. "Who was it then?" he demanded, "that hunted game and brought it to me." In other words, father is broken. He's torn apart when he realizes he gave the bracha to the wrong son. So that's what this lying did to the elderly father, to Isaac. He's now in a tremendous psychological and emotional religious crisis. And let's look at also at 27 verse 34. And henceforth, 34. When Esav heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing and said to his father, "Bless me too, father." But he answered, "Your brother came with guile and took away your blessing."
So he knows who it was.
So he knows who it was. And Esav is broken just like his father is broken by what happened. And we go on to the next verse. Let's go to 38. And Esav said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, father? Bless me too, father." And Esav wept aloud. So Yaakov has hurt terribly two people at least. But the person he might have hurt more is himself. And now we're going to see verse upon verse upon verse upon verse that seem to perhaps describe the psychological and physical aftermath for Jacob himself of his deception and of his thievery. And we're going through the sheet I prepared, D. So it's chapter 27, verse 41. Verse 41. Now Esav harbored a grudge against Yaakov because of the blessing which his father had given him. And Esav said to himself, "Let but the mourning period of my father come, and I will kill my brother Jacob." Jacob becomes a fugitive. When the words of her older son Esav were reported to Rebekah, she sent for her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esav is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now my son, listen to me. Flee at once to Haran, to my brother Laban." And he has to flee to the side of the world in those days because of the aftermath of the act they did. Next set of verses is 29-21. It's a new Torah portion. 29-21. Jacob gets to Laban, to his mother's brother, spends some time there, falls in love with the younger daughter, Rachel, works 7 years to marry her, and then we get to verse 21. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her." And Laban gathered the people of the place and made a feast. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him. And he cohabited with her. Laban had given his maidservant Zilpah to his daughter Leah as her maid. When morning came, there was Leah. So he said to Laban, "What is this that you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?"
He paid him with his own coin.
Laban said, "It's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older. We don't do what you do, that the younger take precedence. By us, we follow tradition. And this is what Jewish tradition calls measure for measure. Midah keneged midah." He got what he dished out. And you wonder if the text of the Bible is not making a statement, look what happens to those who think that the ends justify the means. They get it back, and more so. Let's go on more. 31:6. It's the same chapter. I'm sorry, it's not. 31:6. It's the next chapter.
What was that when we were talking about forgiveness? What not to nurse your...
Nurse your hurt.
Right. He's keeping score.
Yeah. Well, again, Laban is not...
Wasn't part of the deal.
Right, he wasn't part of it. It's not like getting back at him. That's just what happens in the world. 31:6. Says as follows. Jacob has been working for his father-in-law now for a long time. And in verse 6 it says, "As you know, I have served your father," he says to his wives, "with all my might. But your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again." The cheater is being cheated a second time. Not only with the wives, but with the money, and he complains. Right. Well, of course, he could say, "I cheated because of the noble ends. Your father is just doing it because he's a trickster and because he is greedy. Right? So Jacob certainly can make a case, but nevertheless, what's happening to him is happening. Now 31:22. 31:22. So Jacob is really in a tense relationship with his father-in-law. One day he flees, he takes his wives and his children and all the flocks, and he flees from Laban to go home to the land of Israel. On the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him in the hill country of Gilad. In other words, he is now being chased. He's a fugitive. He's a fugitive from Esav, and he's a fugitive from Laban.
Mm-hmm. This is paralleling the Exodus from Egypt too. They leave on the third day, and Pharaoh is informed.
Oh wow! Very good.
I just saw that.
Very good.
There's a parallel here for the Exodus from Egypt, because on the third day that they left Egypt, Pharaoh was told. And
very
so
nice.
He turns around and he pursues them. Yeah.
Please write that down. Write that down and send me an email. That's very interesting. Good. Okay. Oh, you know what? I'm going to say this because I want to be reminded. I was giving the same class last night, and I was talking about how evil, even if it's done for noble ends, may indeed taint us, blemish us, cause us pain. And I just happened to, out of the blue, bring an example I never have thought of. And I said the following. I said, think about the pilot who piloted the plane that dropped the bomb over Hiroshima. Many of us believe that he did the right thing. But he killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Including children.
And think how he lived with himself after that. And then someone in the class said he committed suicide.
After years of mental illness due to,
And I said to her, I said to Alexandria, write that down and send that to me. So can you look it up and send it to me?
Yeah.
If she forgets, that's such a powerful example.
The psychological repercussions are there, whether or not it was.
Yeah. So think of Jacob. Think of Jacob. And the Bible is showing us how he has to live with the consequences of his act for the rest of his life. For the rest of his life. Okay, let's go on. So now we're in chapter 31, verse 31.
And it's even more so, it affects all the people around him, and the children he raises, everything.
Yeah.
For 2,000 years.
Yes.
If not longer. So now Laban is pursuing Jacob. Laban reaches Jacob, reaches the encampment, and confronts him. And we read the following, chapter 31, verse 31. Jacob answered Laban, saying, I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. That's why I fled. But anyone with whom you find your God shall not remain alive. Laban accuses Jacob of stealing his idols. And Jacob says, whoever stole them shall not remain alive. I didn't take them. And in the presence of your kinsmen, point out what I have of yours and take it. Jacob, of course, did not know that Rachel had stolen them.
So that's another thing. He got another liar.
Jacob is being deceived by his wife. And he doesn't know it, of course.
And she lies to her father, just like he lied to his father.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. And then we get to the same chapter. We're still in chapter 31. Now let's go on to chapter 32, verse 7. 32, verse 7. Now, Jacob coming back to the land of Israel. He's coming back to the land where his brother who wanted to kill him lives. 32:7. 32:7. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, we came to your brother Esav and he himself is coming to meet you. And there are 400 men with him. Jacob was greatly frightened. In his anxiety, divided the people with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, the two camps seeking a base of, come to the one camp and attack it. The other camp may yet escape. So after over 20 years, he's being pursued, or thinks that he's being pursued by his brother with 400 armed men, and life for Jacob only gets harder and harder. And perhaps it's all in the aftermath of this terrible deed that he did. And now we're going on to chapter 32:25. That same night he arose, that's Jacob, and taking his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 children, he crossed the ford of the Yabbok. Taking them across the stream, he sent across all his possessions. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn.
Which verse are you in?
I'm in 32:25.
No, you were in 22 to begin. 23.
Yeah, 23, 24, 25. The point is, whatever we think about this mysterious figure that wrestles with Jacob at night when he's alone until the break of dawn, however we parse it, we're not doing anything with it now, it means he was attacked in the middle of the night. Okay? From nowhere. And he's fighting for his life. Again, those are the difficulties that Jacob has in his lifetime. Chapter 34, verses 1 and 2. 34, 1 and 2. Now Dinah, the daughter whom Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Shechem, son of Hamor the Hittite, chief of the country, saw her and took her and lay with her by force. A daughter of Jacob is raped. One of the first things that happens when they come back to the land of Israel. Again, this family has serious troubles. They're
Taurus,
as we say. And we're going on to 35:16-19. 35:16-19. And this is a trial and tribulation that everyone knows about. 35:16-19. Talking about the encampment of Jacob again. They set out from Beit El. But when they were still some distance short of Ephrat, Rachel was in childbirth. She's the beloved wife of Yaakov, and she had hard labor. When her labor was at its hardest, the midwife said to her, "Have no fear, for it is another boy for you." But as she breathed her last, for she was dying, she named him Ben-Oni. But his father called him Benjamin. Thus Rachel died. That's what happens. Another difficulty in the life of Jacob. And that's not all. We go on to chapter 37, verse 18.
What is Ben Oni?
I have a whole class on that. It's not clear what it means. There's okay. At least four different possibilities. I'm going to cruelly push forward. The ends justify the means. 37:18. This is the story of the tension in the household of Jacob, the lack of communication and understanding and brotherhood between the brothers. Joseph is not liked at all, detested by his brothers. And what do? They just about kill him. They saw him from afar in 37:18, and before he came close to them, they conspired to kill him. Brothers conspire to kill a brother. They said to one another, "Here comes a dreamer," etc., etc., etc. "Come, let us kill him and throw him into the pits," etc. Okay? Again, that's what Jacob has to suffer with in his household. And then we go even further. As we go a few verses forward, what happens after they do what they do and they throw him into a pit? Well, what are they going to tell their father? So we're in now verse 31 of the same chapter, where it says, it's 37:31, "Then they took Joseph's tunic, slaughtered a kid." Remind us of something, slaughtering a kid? That was the means with which Jacob deceived his father.
Wow! I never thought about that.
"Then they slaughtered a kid, dipped the tunic in the blood. They had the ornamented tunic taken to their father, and they said, 'We found this. Please examine it. Is it your son's tunic or not?' He recognized it and said, 'My son's tunic.' A savage beast devoured him. Joseph was torn by a beast. Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and observed mourning for his son many days." So the son who deceived his father in turn, as a father, was deceived by his sons, and deceived by his sons in the same fashion with the slaughtering of a kid. So it can't be a coincidence. Clearly, the Bible, the text of Genesis, is making a connection here that it's measure for measure, it's tit for tat, it's midah keneged midah. He's getting a taste of his own medicine, not once, twice. And in addition to the taste of his own medicine twice, his whole life has been ruined. And it looks like there's a message.
And it's also the favorite son is harmed.
Yep. Yep.
In both cases.
We're going to look at some more now. We're going to look at chapter 47, verse 9. Chapter 47, verse 9. At the end of the life of Jacob, he comes down to Egypt. He's reunited with his son Joseph, who did not die, who wasn't killed. And we're reading in chapter 7, verse 9, the following. And Jacob said to Paro, "The years of my sojourn on earth are 130. Few and hard have been the years of my life. Nor do they come up to the lifespans of my fathers during their sojourns." So he says at the end of his life, "I've suffered for many years." And I compare that to the end of the life of Abraham and the end of life of Isaac, in which it said that they lived to a ripe old age and they died full and content. But Jacob dies bitter. And perhaps again, it's all a result of what he did at that fateful time, which he deceived his father and stole the blessing from his brother. And now, I'm going to say something that is, I think, to be unexpected. You might think at this point, after everything we've seen, that the takeaway is that the book of Genesis tells us that the ends, at least in this case of Jacob, do not justify the means. And that's not necessarily the only possible conclusion. How could it not be the only conclusion? Well, some background. You can take the approach, which might be the more straightforward approach at this point, that after everything we've seen, you have to understand that there's a clear message here that the ends do not justify the means, and Jacob's being punished for the evil he did, which means he should not have done it. And that's the position taken by a very, very famous and beloved teacher of mine, Professor Nachum Sarna, who actually is the editor of the JPS Torah commentary that some of you are using, an abridged version of it, like that's the Eitz Chaim?
Oh,
well, I guess I was wrong. No one has the Eitz Chaim. Ah.
Well,
yeah, right, you have it, that's it, right. So he was very, very famous.
It's abridged?
It's an abridged edition of the five-volume JPS Torah commentary.
Well, this is the five-volume.
And that's one volume of the five.
Right.
And it's a fantastic commentary. Professor Sarna taught at Brandeis his whole life, and he was one of the major Jewish Bible commentators of the 20th century. At the end of his life, he retired and moved to Boca Raton, Florida, and I had the privilege of spending 2 years there when he was there. I learned an awful lot from him, both as a friend and as a teacher, and I always like to tell the following story. He was just a wonderfully humble and jolly old man to me. I was a young man, and he was 50 years older than me. There was a custom there in Boca Raton, I'm not sure exactly how this developed, that about 100 people, between 80 and 100 people, would come every Shabbat afternoon to the rabbi's class. Mm-hmm. At 3 or 4 in the afternoon, at least in the summer when there was a lot of time. And it's just so beautiful to stroll outside and come in for a class before Mincha. And as the time went on in Boca Raton, the rabbi was always busy and always frantically preparing his classes. And I was very interested in taking those classes upon myself. So gradually, he let me give more and more of the Shabbat afternoon classes. And I remember that Professor Sarna would come with his wife to every class I gave. And he would just listen and smile. And he never raised his hand and told me how ridiculous everything I sang was. He never criticized. Only if I asked him a question after, "What do you think about this?" Then he would tell me what he thought. But he was just so cute and so polite and so gracious. So anyway, in his Torah commentary, in the Excursus at the end, he has a scathing piece in which he brings all the verses we just read and says it's clear that the Torah's opinion is that Jacob did wrong and he was punished for it his whole life and we should learn never to do such a thing. And the final proof he brings, so on my sheet in E2, E1, is a verse from Jeremiah chapter 9. And it's a verse you'd never know what it really means in the English, because it's a plain word in the Hebrew. We'll read it right now. And this is something that Professor Sarna said to me personally, with great pathos. So it's chapter 9 of Jeremiah, verse 3. Only one verse. And it says as follows. I'll read it in English first, and then we'll see the Hebrew. The English says, and this is a description of the way people are behaving at the end of the first temple period, behavior for which the temple was eventually destroyed. Beware every man of his friend, trust not even a brother. For every brother takes advantage, every friend is base in his dealings. Sounds terrible, but what does it have to do with our subject? But the Hebrew, where the English translates for every brother takes advantage, the Hebrew is, and listen to this, Kol Ach Akov Yaakov. It means every brother Yaakov's his brother. What does to Yaakov mean? It's to heal, to get around, to take advantage. So it's saying that the temple is being destroyed because we all behave like Yaakov did towards his brother. That's a really, really powerful statement. So says Professor Sarna.
So it's Bichya LeDorot.
Yeah. Bichya LeDorot means crying for generations. However, remember I said 2 minutes ago that this is not the only way to parse it. It looks like the majority, the mainstream approach in Jewish tradition is really different. The mainstream approach has been that Yaakov did the right thing, but nevertheless suffered for it his whole life. And that goes back to our pilot at Hiroshima, right? It could be, and this is certainly the way just about all the rabbinic authorities read it, there was no choice, and he took the path of the lesser of two evils.
But it's still evil.
Even evil, which has to be employed, is evil. And you pay for it.
It's like King David was going to build the temple.
Ooh! Three points!
What did he say?
4 points!
What did he say?
Say it again. I said, just like King David wasn't allowed to build the temple, because he spent his whole career was killing people. So right. He wasn't allowed to build the temple.
And what you really meant is see the next page.
Okay.
Very good, very good. I love it. Right. It's a very good point. So, let's see now one of the many sources I brought here. So we're going forward to this photostatic page. This photostatic page. And this is a Midrash Rabbah. Goes back about 2,000 years ago, and it says as follows. When Esav heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry, etc.
This part.
At the top, the bracketed
part. Right, and that's quoting from a verse that we ourselves read 10 minutes ago. Rabbi Hanina said, whoever maintains that the Holy One, blessed be He, that's God, is lax in dispensing justice, may his bowels become lax, which is a big curse. For some of you, it might be a blessing. He is merely long-suffering, but ultimately collects his due. Jacob made Esau break out into a cry but once. And where was he punished for it? In Shushan the castle, as it says in Megillat Esther, the book of Esther, the scroll of Esther. And he cried with a loud and bitter cry, Mordechai. When he heard about the evil decree of Haman Ahasuerus against the Jews, he made a loud and bitter cry, just like Esau made a loud and bitter cry when his brother wronged him. And the idea is that ultimately the Jewish people, the descendants of Yaakov, are being punished by being made to cry. We're being punished for the cry that our forefather made Esau cry. Now, Professor Sarna says, look, here's a proof that right. The rabbis hold that Jacob was wrong, period, and that the ends did not justify the means, and perhaps they never do. But that's not the way most of the rabbis interpret this, as we'll see. Most of Jewish tradition says, yes, the Jewish people paid a price for what we did, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have done it.
So that's the genesis of the long history of suffering.
In a certain sense, it's in the nature of the world that you have to employ evil to fight evil, but the minute you employ evil to fight evil, you're stuck with evil. But that doesn't mean that there's a better course.
What
necessarily.
The path had he not deceived. What would have been the path had he not deceived his brother or his father?
That's a very complicated question, Chris.
I mean, would it have worked out anyway?
Right, and it's hard to know.
Still suffering.
No, but would he have, you know, inherited the?
No, yeah. With Esau. Mm-hmm.
Or he might have had to go to war with his brother and kill him.
Who knows?
And if you look at the inheritance, we're not doing so hot.
Right.
Remember that Jacob said to his mother, when she suggested this, that's what she said. But he said, I will be cursed and not blessed. Well, wasn't he cursed?
Yes.
He was cursed, right? For stealing the blessing, he was cursed.
Yes.
And again, the same question. Do we do the right thing or the wrong thing?
But isn't all of this very selective cherry-picking of verses? He was also a very blessed man. He had, became wealthy. He had four wives as opposed to just one. He had multiple children.
That's like a curse, I think.
Oh, wait a second. That's all credit
for how you think it.
No, that really is a curse. Remember, we had a class on polygamy just three months ago.
Right.
And you told the story about living with a Yemenite family. Right. No, he had a really terrible life. Abraham had a difficult life, but Jacob had a terrible life. And he says the end of his life, how terrible it was. But let's go on. There's some sources that you can't leave the room without looking at. So here we go. Babylon and Talmud, just going right on. We have to read this source and one source after it before anyone leaves. We have 7 minutes. Ula said, both Tamar and Zimri committed adultery. Tamar is the wife of Yehuda, who, if you remember, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Tamar married one son of Yehuda, that son died. Married the second son, that son died. Then according to the custom of the time, she was supposed to marry the third son. But Yehuda, her father-in-law, wasn't willing to give that third son in marriage, and she, through deception, had to do something. What did she do? If she couldn't get the son, she got the father-in-law by setting herself up as a prostitute and seducing him. So she committed adultery. And this, she was supposed to be married to the son, and she took the father, without going into details. Zimri here was the leader of the Jewish people in the book of Numbers chapter 25, who committed adultery with the daughters of Moab and was at the head of a terrible orgy that in the end caused a plague to come upon the Jewish people that killed thousands upon thousands. So it says both Tamar and Zimri committed adultery. Tamar committed adultery and gave birth to kings and prophets. Zimri committed adultery, and on his account many tens of thousands of Israel perished. What a powerful statement of situational ethics. The same act with different moral evaluation based on the consequences. In other words, situational ethics, specifically what type of ethics? Consequentialist. In other words, you judge it on the basis of its consequences. Let's see how the Talmud parses this. But certainly the statement that's being made is that it's not black and white ever. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak said, a transgression performed with good intention, in Hebrew, lishma, for the right reason, a transgression, a crime, a sin, performed with good intention is better than a precept performed with evil intention. It's better to do an avera, transgression, if your purpose is for the sake of heaven, than to do a mitzvah for the wrong reason. Then the Talmud goes on to modify that and say, you know what? A transgression for the good reason is not better than a mitzvah for a bad reason. It's as good. But that's still pretty powerful to say that transgression for a noble end is as good as a mitzvah. Again, very situational. Very much the ends do sometimes justify the means. And then the Talmud brings, I'm going quickly to save time, at the end of that paragraph it brings a verse. And the verse says, it's the one in italics. Blessed above women shall Yael be, the wife of Hever the Kenite. Now, who is this? This is a story in the book of Judges, when Devorah, the prophetess, defeats the Canaanites, and the Canaanite general flees for his life, his name is Sisera, and goes into the encampment to the tent of Yael. And Yael, according to the story...
she deceives him too.
Right, in the book of Judges, the story is that he falls asleep, and while he's sleeping, she takes a tent peg and rams it through his forehead and kills him. But the rabbis understand the story with a little bit more detail to it. Read the beginning of the next paragraph. Rabbi Yochanan said that wicked Sisera had sevenfold intercourse with Yael at that time. As it says, at her feet he sunk, he fell, he lay, etc. What the rabbis are saying is that how did she get him to fall asleep so that she could kill him? By seducing him.
Oh my goodness.
She seduced him no less than seven times, and then he fell asleep, and then she killed him. And that's our subject. That's the end justifying the means. She committed adultery. She was a married woman. But she seduced him in order to kill him because he was the evil general afflicting the Jewish people. Ah, so you see that the ends justify the means, even when you're talking about sexual immorality. But then the rabbis say the following. But she derived pleasure from his intercourse. Rabbi Yochanan said, all the favors of the wicked are evil to the righteous. Now what just went on there is really important. There seems to be an assumption, a hidden assumption, that yes, it's true, that sometimes at least, the ends can justify the means, but under one condition. That the person who does the evil for the noble intention can derive absolutely, positively no pleasure or benefit at all from the act. And therefore, since we assume she got some pleasure out of the intercourse, it's wrong, it can't be. The answer is no, she got no pleasure. All the favors of the wicked are evil to the righteous. Fine. But what we learn from this is perhaps one of the most important things we'll have said in the last 50 minutes, is that the antidote that the rabbis find to the slippery slope is the pleasure principle. It's when you have in front of you the question, the moral dilemma, might it be that I have to do evil to achieve a noble end? Well, you have to debate it, you have to weigh it, because it just might be that the proper thing is to do wrong for the purpose of right. It could be, however, you have to steel yourself, I take that back, you have to test yourself, am I going to get any pleasure out of this? Is there any benefit? Is there any hidden self-interest? Yeah. If there is a hidden self-interest, that might just be the litmus test that tells me I should not do this. Because I can't be totally certain that I'm doing for a noble mean ends. I might be doing it. I can't be certain, but I might be doing it just because I really want to get back at this person for something he did to me 20 years ago. Or 20 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. But you're still going to suffer.
Well, but wait a minute. What about, just to kind of end, within the verses we were reading, Yaakov's going through all this suffering because of his lie. But the lies have an end point, and that's with Yosef, who tests his brothers and disguises himself. And he deceives his brothers as to his identity.
Perhaps you're right, perhaps you're wrong. Perhaps we suffer for generations, like in the book of Yirmiyahu.
Uh-huh.
But what if, let's say, in concentration camp, somebody lied? I read in the book of Primo Levi. He lied in order to get another piece of food.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he got some pleasure out of it because he was hungry and he got
pleasure. He sustained his life.
Right.
He didn't get pleasure out of it. He survived. It's not pleasure.
What he got out of it is exactly the noble end.
He survived.
That's not.
But there was also pleasure of eating. No.
But that's part of the noble end, I think.
Life.
The pleasure would be if he... I don't know. I'm not. I don't know.
It's difficult.
I don't know. I'm not saying that even this is a completely foolproof answer.
Yes.
But we have to see one
it's
more source.
It's something to test your action against.
Mm-hmm. I want to see at least one more source. And that is on the next page, or perhaps it's the back.
You need to decide why you're lying.
What's your motivation?
Well,
right,
why
exactly.
Are you doing it? Are you just doing it? No.
This is written by a rabbi whose acronym is Nitziv, which stands for Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. He lived in Volozhin at the middle and the end of the 19th century. He was the Rosh Yeshiva, the great yeshiva in Velezhin. He died in the last decade of the 19th century. By the way, his youngest son was Rav Meir Berlin, who changed his name to Bar Ilan, and the university is named after him. Right. So this is the father of Bar Ilan University in Israel. He wrote a commentary on the Torah, now reading his own footnotes on his commentary, a commentary on his own commentary, called Harchev Devar, on our famous verses in Genesis chapter 27, verse 9, about the deception we've been reading about. One must know that every evil character trait in the world is part of God's creation. And therefore, all of them contain a certain aspect of good. Behold, this is similar to poisonous drugs. This is written before chemotherapy. That may sometimes have medicinal uses for certain illnesses. However, when they are used to promote healing, the doctor must exercise great care and must use them sparingly, lest he err and endanger the patient. So lying or stealing or any other evil character trait does have its proper use, but it's like chemotherapy. Really dangerous. Tremendously beneficial, but at the same time, really, really dangerous. You have to be very, very careful. And by the way, I looked up in my notes last night preparing the class, and I see that I have a note that says Professor Sarna said to me once that this parable has a parallel in Plato. And I looked it up last night, and I brought in the sheets for you. Plato said the same thing. You can lie, but it's like poisonous medicine being used for a good purpose. Be really careful. So it is with all the evil character traits. They are good under certain circumstances. However, one must be sure to employ them only under the guidance of an expert authority and only sparingly. So Plato said expert authority, they are the rulers of the state. According to the Nesivah, of course, the expert authorities are the rabbinic leaders and scholars. In order not to go further than is necessary, because just one more drop of chemotherapy beyond the dosage and you might kill the patient. Now behold, the time arrived for Yaakov to employ the trait of deception and cunning. And indeed, in his case, it was permitted as a transgression for a noble purpose. However, in Midrash Rabbah that we read, it is said that Yaakov was punished for causing Esav to cry with a great and bitter cry. And this has ultimately brought about the bitter cry of Mordechai. Now, this is seemingly difficult. Why was he punished for Esav's cry? He did the right thing. Why was he punished? Why was he punished any more than for the terrible consternation he caused his saintly father? What does the Midrash say? It's the cry of Esav, and not the pain of his father, that brought about his punishment. Answer. The rather the matter is that in the employment of a transgression for a noble purpose, one must be exceedingly careful not to derive any personal pleasure or benefit from it all. Personal pleasure and benefit, when derives, makes it a forbidden transgression, as is explained in the tract of Yevamot, tract in Nazir, that we just read 10 minutes ago. In this case, Yaakov derived no personal benefit or pleasure from the great consternation he caused his father. Rather, he was certainly quite pained by it, but he had no choice. Such was not the case concerning the cry of Esav. He rejoiced in his heart. Right? He was at odds with his brother his whole life. He was happy to deceive his brother and see his brother cry. And therefore was he punished, for he derived pleasure as a result of his deception, and that is forbidden.
Do you see that he derived pleasure?
We don't see. It's an assumption he makes.
Yeah.
But it's very logical. It's certainly possible.
If it were true.
Yeah. Like took his birthright.
So this is extremely powerful, that we always have to check ourselves. We always, and there are actually two things that have to go on. We have no more time. We won't see other sources, but I'll tell you. Of course, there is, first of all, the question, is this really justified? When I want to, when I think I have to, and circumstances demand that I do evil means for a noble end, well, will the benefit really outweigh the loss, the evil? Is the good really so good? The good to be achieved, does it really outweigh the bad that's to be done? And that requires much thought and much consultation and advice of people who know better than I do. But secondly, the second test is, am I going to get anything out of this? Any benefit, any pleasure? And if I do, then it's not worth it. It's not a good idea. It brings me down the slippery slope, and it might just have a terrible effect on my life. Now, of course, we can ask the question, what happens if we take the Netziv and we say that Yaakov shouldn't have done what he did because he got pleasure, but then what would have happened?
We don't know.
Perhaps there are cases in which, even if you get benefit, you have to do it. I'm going against the Netziv now, because the results will be, if you don't, too terrible. So this is not, I think, a foolproof solution, but it's very powerful, and in most cases in which we live our lives and ask these questions, this might be the litmus test that we should
follow. It's a question
follow.
To ask yourself, but it seems that it's an impossible question to answer, because we're human beings.
Yeah, you can't answer it fully, but you could try.
You can say that Rivka was pushing what God promised, and if God promised, she didn't need to push. She could have waited for God to fulfill.
But it's the same thing with Sarah.
That's part of the question. Right?
Sarah,
right? That's part of the same question.
Yeah. Yeah.
If God promises, okay, so what does that mean? Do I have to now take the effort to make it come true? Probably yes. But do I have to take evil into my hands to make it come true?
And can I justify my evil by throwing it on God's promise?
And if you use the test, you can't benefit. That's such a...
You always benefit.
At what letter? You always benefit. At what level do you benefit?
But you have to get through... Basically, the lesson is instead of just doing evil, you need to make the decision. Am I doing evil for
Obviously.
At some point, you take pleasure in something that benefits you. It's almost impossible.
You can't divide it out.
I suspect even your
I don't buy the test. There's no way you don't think
that. At some point, you go
We don't know why she died. She could have died for a different reason. We don't know all of the.
It seems like
the picture. I wasn't claiming that she died as a punishment to him.
So obviously, this Thursday,
his crime. I was just saying that's what happened in his life. Part of a larger picture.
Don't want to do it. I mean, I'm
forcing you to hear my question.
By the
way, if you're planning on passing Wednesday,
give me a call and let me know.
I won't be here. I'm leaving tomorrow at like 8. I'm going to California.
Okay, you're leaving like everyone else.
Yeah.